Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Morris Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay. And this evening, we got some very, very enlightening information that we're going to bring to you. We're going to be dealing with the Moorish education of our children today. Now, exactly what does that mean, the Moorish education? What's that all about? Because I know a lot of people think education is education. But it is quite interesting that if you would go to China and go into the schools, you discover that the children are being taught Chinese. Chinese education, or education from a Chinese perspective. And so it behooves us that we've been labeled Negro colors and black. Where's the Negro education, the colored education, the black education? What, you know, what kind of education is that? Okay, but when we start dealing with specific information tailored to fit our own children and putting into their consciousness and their brain, they're able to deal with life from their perspective instead of the perspective of someone else, and that is why our label is broadcast as such. What should we teach our children? What about the teaching of world rulership? What type of school should we create? Okay, now these are the topics that we're going to deal with this evening, but before we get started, I want to say that we are offering free articles this evening, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game, Secrets of America, and also the U.S. Bankruptcy and the Moors. And today we're going to concentrate on educating our own children. That's the that's the bottom line, to educate our own children. Now, first of all, for those of you who are on your social sites, if you're on Dig, MySpace, Facebook, Twitter, if you're on any of these social sites, give me your friend request, and I'll grant that. That'll give you access to my wall, because a lot of times we paste articles there. You're able to go there and read them. We'll put them on the main news feed, and then people are able to go there and take their time and read these documents that we put there for you. I've been banned on Facebook for 30 days. That's every month. I don't think a month has went by that I wasn't banned for attempting to befriend my own people, even though I have taken my time and went down the list of friends and even picked out brothers and sisters that have my own same last name. So that lets me know there's a personal attack against me to stop the information that we're putting out here to help the people. Okay? So send me that friend request, and I'll grant it. That'll give you access to my wall. Okay, we'll stop all that foolishness. On August the 16th through the 18th, we'll be hosting the Moorish Summit right here in Jacksonville, Florida. And you all can come on down, and if you just hold on 1 second, we'll give you a little bit more information for those of you who are
greetings.
I'd like to invite you out to the Summit of the Moors, August 16th through the 18th, 2013, located in Jacksonville, Florida. 3 days of executing and planning of executive plans for 25-year agenda, operating as an economic unit. The presenters will be Shem El of the Tamarain 2 Project, Dr. Ali Muhammad and Minister Inki of the Black Genetic Tour, Sundiata Amael, Professor Isef Dean Ham El, Tahaka Amana El, Abundance Child, Fatima, the Alchemist Shabazz, Messiah El, and more. Topics will be the execution of urban geoponics, creating independent distribution systems, creating independent economic systems, genetics, private security force, the wholesale and manufacturing of natural products, Morristown, creating one in every state, Morris Eastside Farms, putting one in every state. You do not want to miss this summit. It is very enlightening, empowering, and most of all, it's applicable. Everything that we talk about, we do. Summit of the Moors, August 16th through the 18th. Log on to www.summitofthemoors.com. You can register for free. The summit is always free. You can also get your hotel room, which will be on the river at the Wyndham Hotel. That's www.summitofthemoors.com. The summits are always free. See you at the summit.
One more time, Moses. Don't forget, for those of you who are trying to do your estate, now, inside the archives, you have your estate manual, you have your estate letter, and you have all the other supporting documents. And for those of you who want to get out there and place that thing in the hands of your employee to stop it from taking taxes out your check, go right to www.newfreehelpgroup.com. Once you get there, look around. If you click on the letters under the picture, a little drop-down menu come back and give you a little additional information on that. But before you do anything, call me, Tahaka Amana El Bay, at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also, for those of you who want to set up your will, all that information is in there as well, right there in the Talkers Master Library. Don't forget, www.newfreehelpgroup.com, okay? All right.
Okay, Moses, we're back. Now, also, I want to mention that tomorrow night, at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I will be on the national conference call for the Moorish American government, and we'll be teaching contract law, so don't miss that. That's the national conference call, and that's held every Wednesday night with our Moorish American government. And the number to dial into that conference call is 559-726-1200. The access code is 107985#. That's 559-726-1200. Access code 107985#. Now, if you want to go back and listen to a previous teaching, you dial 559-726-1299. And, of course, the access code. That's 559-726-1299. If you want to go back and listen to some previous teachings on contract law, very, very informative information. So make sure you dial into that conference call so you can get that. Now, we will hear from Brother Dr. Abdullah Johnson this evening, and we have some more people that we're going to hear from as well. But what I want to say here right now, and first of all, for those of you who have questions and comments, we're running short plugs this evening. Go ahead and raise your hand. We'll be able to open up the line. You can let us know what you think about us homeschooling and teaching our own children. I'd be glad when we get around to making that a priority instead of being a victim of circumstances and saying, well, you know, I got to go to work. I can't do this. I can't do that.
They got to go to school, and we hope they learn something. But at the same time, when you put your children in a public school system, they're being given public knowledge. And we have cases with children that are actually dropping out of school. They're running away from school. They don't. You send them to school, and they go to their friend's house because they can't identify with anything in there. I mean, they go in there, they start telling them about someone else's culture, some other place, anything other than something that they can identify with. So they don't feel like they're learning anything. They can't identify with anything. They don't have any feelings of greatness to know that George Washington was the president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln and Columbus discovered America. How you going to get anything out of that? You can't get nothing out of that. There's nothing in there to make you feel proud about nothing, because you have been written out of what's called the respectable commentary of history. I can't understand where they get the word respectable from. I mean, if you invaded somebody else's land and murdered people and wrote history, which is your story, how all of a sudden became respectable after the murders? Help me. You got to excuse me. I just use common sense. I look at a rabbit and call him a rabbit. I'm not accustomed to looking at a rabbit and calling him a lion. That's just, you know, I can't just swallow something. I had to, you know, you come to me with something, I need to know exactly what you're talking about. You know, I can't go for no okie doke. I can't understand, because, I mean, I went to school. Don't get me wrong. I was in the school. They told me the same stuff. They even had me believing that it was something that I supposed to know, that would cause me to achieve something real. And one thing that I did know is that all the great men that I knew that I could identify with that looked like me never went to school. None of them. And all of them had plenty of everything they needed. They raised their children, had nice homes and all this stuff, had gardens and cows and horses and, you know, but all of a sudden we've been led to believe that to send our children to a public school system that they're going to benefit. Well, it's been going on for quite some time now in America. And the only thing that I see is people that look like me with somebody else's consciousness in their brain. That's exactly how I see it. I mean, now, if I'm wrong, go ahead and raise your hand. Straighten me on out. I'm just calling it like I see it. I could be wrong. I mean, I watch the children today, and I see them walking down the street. They come past the house. They got this iPod. They plugged up. They bouncing around. They listening to music. I don't see anybody doing anything that's remotely resembling any kind of education or knowledge about nothing. I don't see it. Foul language, improper dress, the women, the girls and the boys. I mean, fighting in the streets. This kind of stuff has been going on for quite some time, but I feel like if we have graduated into a high technological age, why is it that I don't see any major changes in our children? And I ain't talking about nobody else's children. I'm not talking about Caucasian children. I'm not talking about Jewish children. I'm not talking about Spanish children. I'm talking about the ones that look like me. Them the ones I'm talking about. Now, don't get me wrong. This ain't got nothing to do with racism. I'm just telling you what I'm looking at and what I believe that I'm supposed to look at, because my children look like me. My sisters and brothers look like me. All my cousins look like me. All my uncles, my granddaddy, my great-great-granddaddy, my grandmother, great-great-grandmother, all of them look like me. So I'm trying to figure out, why is it now all of a sudden, because it's supposed to be 2013, that all of a sudden I'm supposed to be more than cultural about something. Amazing. Anyway, we're going to take a little quick look at some things here, and it's going to be a brief look And let's see. Children are interested in that. Okay. We're going to take a little quick look at some things and see what's going on with this thing. And I mean, I'm just looking at it as I see it, based on what I see going on in America. Okay? And I definitely want some audience participation on some of this stuff so that y'all can, you know, straighten this thing out. Who knows? Maybe I've been looking at it wrong or something, you know. So this is what I want to deal with on this stuff. Okay, I see I didn't do that. All right, so let's go here. Here we go. Hold on.
Let's talk about some solutions. What do you see as a way of correcting and stopping some of the issues and challenges that are facing our people today?
As it relates to solutions, there's two. One is proactionary and preventive, and the other is reactionary and based on coming in after the problem has been created to do something about it. Let's start with the proactionary institution. If you look at most of what America uses, at least 50% of the inventions that made this country famous came out of the minds of African Americans and came out of our minds before we was allowed to go to school with white students. I think that we have to rethink our push for school desegregation. I think that we have to go back to building our own schools for our children. We have to look at our definition of education. Up until now, the definition of education for African American youth has been to teach them how to function within the American social order, how to be a part, how to be an employee. That needs to change. My definition of education is the art of teaching children how to acquire, protect, and maintain power. In other words, I am not interested in preparing my child to work for Microsoft. I'm interested in preparing my child to build the corporation that's going to rival Microsoft's dominance in the computer age. So we have to shift from working for people as opposed to dominating the industries. Five sciences need to be taught to African American children that I don't see being taught by any school in this country, not all at once, be it private, public, parochial, or charter. Number one is agricultural science. There is no culture without agriculture. Our children have to be taught how to grow their food, and they must also be taught agronomical science so they can actually test the soil to make sure that the fruits and vegetables that they do grow actually have some nutritional content in them. So that's number one. You got to be able to sustain life. Our people are dying from all sorts of preventable diseases. Most of our deaths are not natural deaths. They are preventable due to poor diet, poor nutrition. Agricultural science helps to deal with that. The second science that should be taught is nutritional and dietary science. In addition to learning how to grow the food, you have to know when to eat, how to eat, and what to eat. Okay, you go back 75 years ago, there was breakfast, there was lunch, and there's dinner. Now you have African Americans eating all day long, never giving their stomach time to rest. And the research showed that there's a direct relationship between how often you eat and how long you live, even if you do eat healthy. The third science is political and military science. Our children don't just need to be taught history. History is important, but it's not enough. They have to be able to relate it to the present. So history and political science goes together. History, our experience of the past. Political science, our experience of today. Why is there a mass incarceration project going on amongst African-American males? Why don't public schools work? What's going on with black male-female relationships? And are there some outside influences that's contributing to the destruction of the African-American family? We need our children to be politically conscious of what's being done. Why is President Obama president of the United States? And is it necessarily a good thing for African people, not just here, but in Africa as well? Then we also have to teach them economic and financial science, the science of money. African Americans are financially illiterate, even those of us who are well-educated, financially illiterate. I want our students to be able to build multinational corporations, to be able to invest in the resources under the ground of our mother continent of Africa and bring them to ground so that they can be used to rebuild our race internationally. Military science, so they can understand military strategy. The black community globally and locally is at war. There's war against black men. There's war against black people. You see it every day with the abuse that we suffer from the police. We just had a situation in California with a former officer, Dorner, who actually wrote a letter, you know, detailing the racism that he experienced on the police force in L.A. Our children need to be taught these things. They also need to be taught spiritual science so they can understand their connection to the divine. We are divine people. And so astrological science and the teaching of ancient African spiritual systems above and beyond Islam and Christianity, I think, is going to be key towards our resurgence in the modern world. And the last science is the science of the black family, the science of the black man and the black woman. The black man has forgotten how to respect his queen, and the black woman has forgotten how to respect her king. She has to be taught the black man as a science, and the black man has to be taught the black woman as a science. Those six sciences are going to serve as the cornerstone for a global African revolution and renaissance, and they're not being taught right now. So the preventive solution is to build our own schools. It is not realistic to expect middle-class white women to properly educate black boys. It is never going to happen. Now, let's talk about the reactionary things that we can do. What we can do right now, as the situation is, black parents need to organize themselves into an independent black parents association. Independent means we don't take money from other people and we don't allow others to participate in our organizational efforts. That's been a big mistake of African-American people throughout our history. You look at other groups in this country, they organize by themselves, as you're supposed to do. Family business is private, but not so with African-Americans. We include everybody to our table and wonder why we can't get ahead, because we're not doing things for ourselves and by ourselves. Every black public school district in this country should have an independent black parents association that consists of four committees. Number one, special education committee, to investigate the special education abuse of black children, and also to investigate how the special ed money is being spent. Special education is a business, it is a hustle, it is a racket. Whenever I diagnose a child with a disability and place them in special education, the school district gets extra money every year that that child is in special ed. That money should be spent on those students, but we find that it's not. It's being spent on everything but those students. The second of the four committees should be school discipline. United States Department of Education just came out with research a few months ago that said African-American boys are being suspended and expelled for the same offenses as white boys, but in an excessive fashion. Okay, so clearly there is academic racism there, because even the United States DOE is saying that it exists. We have to investigate which schools are doing it, which teachers are responsible, which principals are responsible. Let's step in and do something about it. Third committee, school finance. Where is the money going? My argument is that money is not our biggest problem in education. It is not. Yes, you can always use more money, but that's not why our children are not learning. We don't have a budget crisis. We have a spending priority crisis. If you notice, the football team always gets what they need, and the basketball team always gets what they need, but the students in the classroom don't always get what they need. I would argue that although we have a budget issue, more money is needed. The bigger problem is the priorities upon which the district and principals are spending their money. And a fourth committee is school policy. There are local school policies that are in place that detrimentally and negatively affect African American children. I give you an example. In some school districts, if you use profanity or make a threat against someone, you're automatically referred for school expulsion. Those should not automatically be expellable offenses. They might be suspendable offenses, but to remove a child from an education for the rest of their childhood, we have to really look critically at these types of policies, the zero tolerance policies that get you kicked out of school if you bring something to school that even remotely resembles a weapon, even if you have no history of misconduct in the school. So we need a policy committee to investigate. Those four committees, organized by African Americans who are economically independent of the school district, but come into the school to work with the educators and lawmakers to bring about necessary change, could get us some progress until such time that we build our own schools. And there's no reason why every African-American child in America cannot go to a school that is run by their own community. African-American people in this country gross $1 billion in the American economy. We are the richest group of Africans on the face of the earth, and the 10th to 12th richest group of people on the face of the earth. And with that type of money, we could build all the schools that our children need, so there is no excuse. We could take our Christmas money. Philadelphia, we spent $3 billion on Christmas gifts. New York City, $8 to $12 billion on Christmas gifts. We could just take our Christmas money and build a new educational reality for our children.
In building those institutions, the pushback will be, first of all, I want my child to have a wider exposure. And if you're saying that it's not the environment, it is the instructor, why can't an instructor who's not African-American, who is committed, who believes the children can learn, would not be suitable in the classroom? And what do you say to parents who are concerned with their child going to school and coming home safely? We're looking at least 5 deaths in this area that have occurred with young people on school grounds or going to school, coming from schools. There's a lot going on in the community where you would have parents say that it's not just going to school. There is a whole environment that is so detrimental and so toxic that before we get to building a school, we have to get to having a community. We have to have some kind of understanding that the spirituality you talked about, that a life is valued, that a life that looks like you or looks like doesn't look like you is valued. And how do you get to those challenges? And additionally, you're sounding excellent and you're sounding Stankovic, looking back to go forward, because we had that kind of mentality and drive where we wanted our own schools and we shipped school students through it who came out excellent because they had that loving environment. But how realistic is that to go into a community and say that you have got to build a school in order for your child to learn if your position is that what you really need are teachers who care?
First, I would say that any teacher can teach an academic skill if they're committed to the child. The issue is not that white educators or Asian educators or Hispanic educators can't teach African-American children. That's not the issue. The question is, do they come to the table with the commitment and compassion to reach those children? That's number one. Number two, it also relates to your definition of education. If your definition of education is only the imparting of academic skills, teaching a child how to read, write, and do arithmetic, any teacher of any color can do that. But if your definition of education is like mine, which is greater than reading, writing, and arithmetic, and is about preparing the children of an oppressed group of people to actually take back power and how to survive an unjust society, okay, that cannot be taught by somebody who didn't experience it. Only a black man can prepare a black boy for how to deal with racism in the moment. When you're pulled over by the police, don't react emotionally, young man, okay? Simply speak to him by calling off the numbers on his badge ID, and you refer to him as that. Yes, officer 3519, how can I help you? Did I do something wrong, officer 3519? When a teacher disrespects you in a classroom, you don't respond. You put that down on paper, and you give it to your parent, and then it's your parent's job to come back and fight that war with the teacher. Not you. You're a child, and you have to be respectful. We who are black men, we've been through that. We can teach it. Can't no white man teach a black boy how to deal with white racism. Just like can't no white woman teach a black girl how to deal with the effects against her self-esteem that she's going to have to deal with by her skin being dark or her hair being curly or kinkled. So there's a lot that has to relate to education, including knowledge of self, that cannot come from someone from outside your community. It has to come from the inside if that's your definition.
But why should that be the school's job? My position is, and I want you to address this when it comes to the responsibility of the community, shouldn't our children leave with all of that? Why are we going to send a child to an institution to have them teach self-esteem or to the value of your beauty or how to do the things that you've vocalized? Why isn't that done before the child even gets to the school? Because if your position is they're not compassionate or there is not that loving, nurturing environment, why would we even wait for that, those type of very important core value things to be taught in an academic institution?
Very good question. Here's the key from my perspective. Education is a community institution. That's exactly why I argue that we need to build our own schools for our children. Education is a function of the community and should be run, supervised, implemented, and administered by the community, not an outside group. So I don't think we're disagreeing there. I think we're making the same point. Because schooling is a function of culture, and because schooling is a function of the community, it should be done within that community. So that actually makes my argument that we need to build our own schools because only we can impart the correct cultural ideal and vision into our children. They can't get that on the outside. That's exactly the reason why we need to build our own schools.
Again, and we perhaps are agreeing, the only thing that I would say is I would like you to address more of the family issue before it even leaves for a community school. What are we doing within that family to, even if we're sending them to a community school? Because realistically, everybody in a community school it's not going to be, we're not a people all on one page. Mm-hmm. We have different ideas about a lot of things. So how are we going to ensure that before the child leaves the door, the family structure, that nest is built there, that mm-hmm. self-confidence is
there? I don't think those things are separate. I think administering the education, administering the economics, administering the spirituality, and looking after the needs of the family are all aspects of the organization of a community. So I don't see them as separate. I don't see them as being in a prioritized order, as being hierarchical. I see them more as being horizontal, things that occur, because things that co-occur together. In order to solve our issues, we're going to need a multi-systemic, multimodal approach, which means we're doing different things all at the same time. We're taking care of the family at the same time we're educating. We're educating at the same time we're employing. We're employing at the same time we're taking care of the psychological needs. We're taking care of the psychological needs at the same time we're looking at our political situation. So I don't see as one necessarily being more important than the other. They are simultaneously important because each is crucial to our well-being and future development. I would say this, our biggest drawback is our mindset, as you said, post-traumatic slavery disorder, the petty differences. And I think in order for us to get out of that, we're going to have to do what? Grow, raise an entire new generation of African children who are able to think the way that we need them to think. Going back to Dr. Carter G. Woodson's book, Miseducation of the Negro, what did he tell us? The college-educated black is seldom of any use to his race. The education he gets in college educates him against the best interests of his race. Before he went to college, he saw himself as a part of his community and saw himself as being proud of being a member of that community. But once he comes back from college, be it a HBCU or a predominantly white school, he sees himself as different. So you have a schizophrenic political mindset being created in educated blacks that makes them liabilities as opposed to possibilities for their people.
Okay, Moses, we're back. Now, that was quite interesting. And brother has, and his sister have given us an excellent platform of things that we need to consider involving our the education of our own children. And I think that definitely starts at home. I mean, if you got children, you're responsible for these children, and most of us would agree that we are responsible for these children. But, excuse me, at the same time, we have to take in consideration that we have to be responsible for their education as well. So we're just going to have to buckle down and just face the fact that we're going to have to start talking to our children and getting them to understand the overall picture and stop putting in their brains that they got to be prepared to be servants. You got to stop that. You got to prepare your children for leadership. Go ahead and point out to them the greatness. And history is vital. It's a very integral part of education. I mean, you cannot feel good about anything if you don't know anybody you can identify with that have done anything great. So it behooves us to start doing this, start teaching our children ourselves long before they ever go to kindergarten. And we got situations now, and I have ran into more than one situation with sisters that had children. And when I attempted to give them a different thinking pattern, she stepped in and stopped me, which caused me to immediately leave her and go on to the next sister. And this has been more than one time. And but I don't waste any time with foolishness. I mean, you got a child, you programming the child incorrectly, and I'm sitting there looking at you, and then you're going to tell me, well, I don't want him to have that kind of thinking. You know, it's this kind of the kind of thinking that you have. You know, people. I don't want my child to be hurt. I you know, I say, okay, well, I tell you what, let me get out your way. And you go on, poor child. But I had to move on. Anyway, if you got any questions or comments, go ahead and raise your hand, and we'll open up the line so you can tell us how you see it. Personally speaking, I think a child needs to be, especially if you have young sons, the male plays a very, very important part in that young man's life. And for him to grow up without that automatically creates a balance, an imbalance in his life. We have sisters who think that they can raise a son, but you can't. You can sustain one, but that in order to raise one, that takes the parental coalition of a man and a woman. Now, notice I use the word man. I didn't say anything about a boy masquerading as one. I said a man. There's a difference. And sisters know the difference. There's a lot of I've ran into a lot of sisters out there that don't know what to do with a man. And this is, you know, this might seem kind of rough, but don't y'all jump on me all at one time. I'm just telling you how I see it and what I have run into during my lifetime. It is amazing. I asked them. I have even had a sister. I sat her down right there in front of me. I say, what you looking for? She said, I'm looking for a good man. I said, man? She said, yes, right, a good man. I said, okay, what are you going to do with one when you get him? Well, I'm going to do everything that a woman's supposed to do. I said, could you give me some details? Well, you know. I said, no, I know, but I'm asking you what you know. Well, the usual stuff. I say, like what? Could you give me a description? Could you break it down to me? I said, hold on, let me get a piece of paper so I can write down your description. Well, I don't want to give no description. I said, well, you say you're looking for a real man, and I want to know what you're gonna do with one. Because if you're looking for a man, you most certainly should be prepared to know what to do with one if you get him. Because if you don't, you're going to have a problem. Anyway, I just wanted to point some of that out. Now, and the reason I'm saying this here is because I have witnessed some sad situations here among us, and we got to straighten this mess out. And we got to do some definition of some terminology around here so that we can get some clarity on some things, which will automatically lead to some direction and some plans that we can implement and carry some things out. Now, we know we need to be growing our own food. We need to, the child needs to understand agriculture. He needs to understand science. So now, how are you going to teach that to them if you don't know anything about it? I mean, it's, to me, it's just common sense. And so I think what we do a lot of times, since we don't know these things, we depend on somebody else to know them, and we'll turn our children over to them, and we'll turn their brains over to them, and then we expect them to act in a certain way, and in some kind of way, by some hook or crook, they're going to make it in life. Some God gonna come in some kind of way and help them out. Well, why don't you save God some time and do something with the very children that God gave you? Why don't you do something about that? You know, it's interesting because I witnessed this stuff over and over and over, and I hold interviews with people, and I talk to people all the time, all over, you know, even out in the streets. I ask questions, and the answers I get is sometimes quite phenomenal. I thought I had learned a lot of things, but I'm still finding out that there's some serious situations going on in the United States among people of African descent or Moorish descent. Now, when it comes to putting the Moorish knowledge into the brains of the children, in order for us to do that, we're going to have to learn everything about it. What about the Moors? What about their ancient story? Who were the ancient Moabites? You know, what happened in Spain? What happened in the Americas? What What information do we have that we can point our children to for their study so they can learn everything about it? Otherwise, they have Negro, they have color, they have black, and all of this represents a nationless person. And I use the word person, not man or woman, but person. And if we learn this stuff and we pass this on to our children, they can learn about it. I mean, if it's a fact and it's actually happened, it involves the Moors. So tell us about the Moors. What about the Moors? Why is it that it is the image of African Moors that appear on the coat of arms of the royal families of Europe? Who was J.A. Rogers? What is his book about? Race Knows No Color Line. What's that about? What is the book about Stanley Lane Poole, The Moors in Spain? Let's get some of this information out there and expose it to ourselves, and then we can begin to expose it to our children, right?
Welcome to another episode of Samori Speaks. As many of you know, me and a couple committed friends of mine, we started an African-centered school down here in New Orleans. And our school, which is home base, is right across the street from a local high school. And every day, around lunchtime, a little bit before, a little bit after, we see about 6 to 10 high school students running away from that high school. I mean, they look like, you know, enslaved Africans trying to get to the hills, trying to get to those maroon communities, trying to get free. Right, so one day I said, you know what, I'm going to stop them. I'm going to stop a couple of them and ask them why they keep running away from this school. And so the next day, sure enough, about 6 to 10 of them were running to get out of there. I stopped two friends. And I said, yo, man, why are y'all running away from this school? Like, every day I see people running. Why are y'all running away like that? So he looked at me up and down. He looked at his boy, right? And then he looked back at me as if to say, who is this cat? Why is he asking me these questions? So I let him, I say, look, I'm not going to report you to the principal or anything like that. So I just really want to know, right, because we have a school right down the road here. So, again, he looked at his friend, then looked at me, and he said, well, I mean, they ain't teaching us nothing over there. And what they do teach us is not relevant to me, so I got better things to do. I didn't engage him on the better things to do, but I did talk to him a little bit more about some other things, right? So hit him with some knowledge from The Falsification of African Consciousness by Amos Wilson. Put him on some knowledge from Asafo, The African Warrior's Guide to Manhood by Imamoglu Baruti, right? Just put him on some of those things. And after that conversation, he said to me something that many students who've been having problems with school, students who have actually dropped out, have said to me over the last couple of years. And he said, man, if I had a teacher like you, I would love school. If I had a teacher like you, I would love school. And all I got for him is love. And I think Brother Booker T. Washington said it most eloquently to me. He said, it's not that our children are not interested in school, but it is that the buildings and the schools that we send our children into are not into them. Our children are interested in school. And our children are waiting for us to build those institutions, to build those rites of passage programs that teach them about themselves and make them understand their purpose in life. Our children are waiting for us to revive schools or build those African center programs, those African center school after school programs, whatever. They are waiting for us. Too often, we just talk about what's going on, and not often enough do we do anything about it. Just remember, our ancestors, our children, and the unborn are waiting for us to be the Africans that we say we are. I'll see you next time.
Okay, Moles, we back. Now, that was interesting. Like the brother say, he's seeing some children run away from the school. And I remember experiencing the same thing. Kids, we had some kids, they every day their parents send them to school, and every day They go in a different direction. They never went in there because they were like, man, of course, we had been bussed, and they came from our all so-called black community and sent to a all Caucasian-dominated school. And, when they got up in there, everything, didn't nothing make no sense to them about nothing. They were listening to rock music and, ooh, man, you talking about a culture shock. This was the worst thing that ever could have happened to us inside this country here, the busing thing. The busing and then the integration. That is, to me, that is a phenomenon. To see it with my own eyes is amazing. When I see it, it's like amazed wonderment. I was coming out of a restaurant one day, and I saw this guy. He was a Hispanic guy, and he had a little girl. This little girl couldn't have been no more than 3 or 4 years old, maybe a little bit older. It's hard to judge. But her mother was a woman of African descent, and the mother was trying to, because the child, and I knew that, because the child looked just like her, same color and everything. But her mother was trying to get her hand, and she told her mother, get away from me, nickel. She said, I want to be with my dad. I don't want you holding my hand. And I looked dead in her face. When I did, she dropped her head. And her husband, he wouldn't look me in the eye either. And I was like, what in the H is this, man? What is this? What kind of thing is this? Coming out of a restaurant, it was loud and clear. I mean, she was loud, and she got in the truck and jumped in the front seat with her daddy. And her mama tried to get in there. She said, "You ought to get in the back." And I sit there in my vehicle and just looked at him. I said, "This is amazing. I can't believe what I just witnessed." Nevertheless, I did. Unbelievable. But anyway, this was, to me, it was, I never seen anything like that in my life. And so I don't know what was going on in our household or what has happened, but it was quite a shocking experience. One more time, Mose, don't forget, for those of you who are trying to do your estate, now, inside the archives, you have your estate manual, you have your estate letter, and you have all the other supporting documents. And for those of you who want to get out there and place that thing in the hands of your employee to stop it from taking taxes out your check, go right to www.newfreehelpgroup.com. Once you get there, look around. If you kick on the letters under the picture, a little drop-down menu will come back and give you a little additional information on that. But before you do anything, call me, Tarka Amana L. Bay, at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also, for those of you who want to set up your will, all that information is in there as well, right there in the Talkers Master Library. Don't forget, www.newfreehelpgroup.com, okay? All right.
With the things I've been knowing.
Hi, my name is Larry White, and I am your producer and director of The Inner Beat. The Inner Beat is a socially conscious program that sometimes showcases cultural events as well as community events. And occasionally, we'll even bring a little song and dance. So sit back and enjoy The Inner Beat.
I came to know Dr. Clark through his writings. before I met him personally. And when I met him personally, I was struck by this man with the intellectual bullets. I knew a great deal about the physical bullets that people have that wipe out other people and that frighten them and that bring them to their knees with fear. But the intellectual bullets, which this small, soft-spoken, rather inconspicuous human being brought to our community, to academia, was very, very gratifying to me. And I would like to share with you those pieces of his life which were so meaningful to me. In the first place, he was truly a gifted man. There's no question about the fact that he's a gifted man. And I say he is a gifted man because his influence still lives among us. That is important because he came from very humble beginnings. And very often today, even though we think we have grown past the kinds of hypocrisy that were imposed upon us by the oppressor, we still tend to not value people who come from humble means. This is particularly true of children. Teachers very often don't see the genius in children who come from humble means, children who come from poverty, children who come from the housing project, children who come from families that are considered broken but have been broken by society, those that wear their pants down lower than they should and their hairstyle is not what we think it should be. We don't see past those superficialities to see the giftedness and the genius that's in these youngsters in order to help to develop that genius. Dr. Clark was also very much self-educated, as Dr. McIntosh said. When he went to Hunter College to head the department, he did not have the earned credentials. Here again, very often, we make the mistake of thinking that it's only those people who have those earned degrees, and I want them to have the earned degrees. I think it's extremely important, and I try in every way to encourage every young person to get every credential that they can possibly get. But I also know that there are people with wisdom and sagacity who are self-taught, who have read, who have traveled, who have lived, and who have functioned in keeping with the findings of their life. And certainly Dr. Clark did that. But he also went on, once he was in academia, to earn the full degrees. Shortly before his death, he finished that earned doctorate. And I commend him for the fact that he never stopped. The last time I spoke with him, when he was in the hospital approximately 2 weeks before he died, he was talking about what he was going to do. Even in his illness, he was. And many of us who so-called have retired intellectually and spiritually and emotionally. We have removed ourselves from the fray. We have become connoisseurs, meaning that we don't sing, we don't dance, we don't teach, we don't write, we don't give. We just evaluate what everybody else does. And that's what I call the connoisseur. But we have no ability, no right to retire with as much as there is to do, to read, to sing, to teach, to give, to forgive. I admire that about him. I also feel that Dr. Clark presented to our people an alternative philosophy of living. And that's what's lacking with our young people today. They only know the American system because by strategy, the system of African consciousness, of African culture, of African tradition has been omitted from the curriculum of the public school system, and most of our children only have access to that system. So they don't know any alternatives. They don't know anything but meism. They don't know anything but materialism. They don't know anything but instant gratification. And so where do they hear another voice saying there's another way, that there is a different value system that is communal, that is collegial, that's caring, that's humane, a system that built kingdoms and worlds and philosophy and psychology and medicine and endured for thousands of years? and that it is that value system which will give your life meaning and purpose. And when we talk about that value system, sometimes people ask me, well, what do you mean by an African value system? Africa is a continent. It's not a country. What do you mean when you say that? Actually, although Africa is a continent, Africa has a commonality among all of the various nations in Africa. Ancestor worship, understanding that the spirit of the ancestors lives with you, and they protect you, and they can whisper words of encouragement and wisdom to you. Another great African philosophy is our responsibility for the children. We have long neglected that. But in the African psychology, we have a responsibility for the children.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking in the head. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be.
Okay, Mose, we are back. Now, that is interesting because we're talking about the Moors, and usually what people will think is when I'm talking on this broadcast and I'm talking about people of African descent that I'm only speaking about those inside the United States, but no, we have our people all over the world. And so wherever they are, when they tune into this broadcast, we want to hear from all of them. We've heard from our brothers with African accent and sisters with different accents and stuff from different places. But it's all directed to our people as a whole. When I say a Moorish education, I really mean that. That is something that we really need to take a look at. I mean, I feel it's only fair. I really do. I mean, if we have looked at everything else and everybody else on the planet, and we've been given all kind of information about, we've been given information about Spanish and Portuguese, and we've been given information about the Japanese, the Koreans, the Chinese, and all these people. Why would it be so wrong to learn something about the Moors? Okay, well, you know, what is that about? Well, let's find out. Let's go do an investigation on that. I mean, we've learned, been exposed to everything else and everybody else, and about all these other things over and over and over again, to a lot of this stuff has become institutions. But now, when you say Moors, oh, I don't know nothing, man. I don't want nothing to do with them. I don't want nothing to do with them. I don't know nothing about that. I don't want to do them. Okay. But what's the problem? What was the problem? I mean, they made it mandatory for you to understand and get an education about Spanish, didn't they? They made it mandatory, and they had us when we was in school. They was talking to us about civics. They say, okay, one of the subjects that you have to take is civics. You got to take civics, and then they told us that you got to learn French. I come from a community of everybody that looked like me. Everybody in there spoke the same language. We didn't know nothing about Africa. That was out. We can't learn nothing about that. But you got to be, if you fail French, then you got a problem. You're going to have to go back and take French again. Okay. We don't even have a car. So if I learn French, I'm going to go drive somewhere to find a French person to talk to. But then when you say Moorish, the Moors, teach your children about the Moors, a lot of people, well, I don't want anything to do with it. I don't know anything about it. I don't want to, do nothing with that. That's okay. All right. But it is very interesting, and if you pay attention to what's going on and what's being said and stuff, and really examine the thinking of a lot of people and question where they get this kind of thinking from, you may be quite amazed. It's very interesting to talk to certain people. A lot of people, they get annoyed with me because I get to digging for some stuff. They were like, oh, my goodness, what are you up to? Oh, I don't want to deal with this brother right here. He coming with some more stuff.
Just to add, and I'm just going to reiterate my point, Obama's act that he signed was not the first time that the military was authorized to police a city. It was in the Patriot Act, and even before then, there's executive orders that was written on that. But here's my thing. I know the brother mentioned about going out to the polls and voting. Again, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree. Black people are not the majority in any state in this country. In no state are black people the majority. So even if all black people would have came out to vote, it would have still been a very difficult job to make a state legislature predominantly black in any country, in any state in this country. The only elections that black people are really able to control and influence the outcome are municipal, those in the cities and in the towns, those types of elections. State elections and federal elections, it is almost impossible for black people to influence the outcome, especially if you want to talk about putting a black person in office. Not that I favor that anyway, because most black people who go to office, they're not accountable to the people who sent them there. I think in terms of the brother stating that the Stand Your Ground law, he doesn't have a problem with that. He has a problem with the application. But I would have to argue there's no difference between the law itself and its application. These laws are created for white people, by white people, and in the interest of white people. When they draft the law, they already have in mind how the law is going to be applied. So I'm not sure how we can say we don't have a problem with the law, but we have problem with the application when the law was designed with the application in mind. So if the law is being used in a certain way against black people, then obvious it was designed to be used that way. I don't see a separation between the law and the application because the law is only as good as the application. And if you have a Stand Your Ground law being created by white racist state legislatures, how and in what way could that law ever be of any benefit to black people?
Well, I'll respond to that. I disagree with you on black people not being able to influence elections because white people are not all voting together as a bloc. You got your liberals,
they don't
you
have
got
to.
Your conservatives.
They don't have to. We are not a minority. We are not the majority in any state. The majority wins the election.
We don't have to be the majority, sir. We do not have to be the majority. All we have to do is stand together as a voting bloc, like many of the other ethnic groups do. So I disagree with you there, but I do agree with you on the especially the local elections, like your sheriff, like your county DA, like your county judges. But that is where the law is being misapplied, is at the municipal level. When we look at the
criminal laws are made on the state level, they're not made on municipal. Criminal laws are made on the state level. And even if you stand together as a bloc, you're talking about getting – hold on, let me finish now, and please don't dominate the interview. I believe I'm the one being interviewed here today, not you. But you're not – if you're talking about you're going to get all the black people together from every county in a particular state to stand together to bring about a particular change, what particular strategy are you going to use to do that? You're talking about getting all the black people in a particular state to stand together on a particular issue? How are you going to do that? I want to see how that's going to get done. You have a difficult enough time organizing black people in a city. You're talking about an entire state. I take Pennsylvania, 67 counties, black people are 10%, and you're going to get all them to come together and vote in a specific way. You can't even do that in a city, more or less an entire state. I just think you have too much faith in the law. And my position is that we can bring about change through our own organization. Electoral politics serves a small function within the overall framework of black progress. I do not think we should be looking at it as the be-all, end-all, nor is it the primary medium of black progress. You talked about how we swept President Obama into office. We didn't sweep anybody into office. The President of the United States is chosen by the Electoral College. The people have never chosen a president in American history, nor will they ever. And if you look at the popular vote between McCain and Obama, you'll see that McCain only beat Obama by 3 million votes. That is the size of a small state. That is the only edge he had in the popular election. Obama won by a landslide in the Electoral College. So again, I differ. Black people did not sweep Obama into office, not that that was anything positive anyway, but it was the Electoral College that swept Obama into office and the previous 43 presidents. People do not choose presidents. They never have, and they never will.
Dr. Umar, I never said that black people swept Obama into office. I said they turned out to vote in record numbers. Obama was elected, and the Democrats were swept into Congress and the Senate as they control both houses. I never said that electoral politics is the end-all and be-all. I believe all options should be on the table. When you're talking about this racist, white supremacist system that we're fighting, we can't afford to leave any option unused. And, you know, I have to disagree with you again with the Stand Your Ground. Yes, the legislators passed the law, but it is the county prosecutors, and even in Trayvon Martin's case, Norm Wolfinger, who was the state attorney for that district, made the decision to not charge George
Zimmerman. And you think he made that decision alone? I mean, you actually think the officials make those decisions alone? So what you're saying is that you believe that a black person will be able to kill a white person and invoke the Stand Your Ground law as his defense? On what basis would you believe such a thing?
You actually believe that
the courts are that colorblind, are that full of justice, that a black person will be able to kill a white person and invoke the Stand Your Ground law? You believe that?
Yeah, it did happen in the state of Georgia. Okay, in the state of Georgia, a black man was attacked by a disgruntled contractor who was working on his house. He went to the man's house without his permission. The black man's son calls his father, lets him know. He calls 911 and reported to the police, rushes home. Then this white man tries to attack him. He shoots him dead. The police rule it as a self-defense. The neighbors even, you know, gave their statements that, yeah, this white man was trying to attack him. He was defending himself. But then a bunch of racist white people decided to start a campaign to get this black man charged by writing the local prosecutor. And then a year later, after this man has been already granted immunity, this prosecutor decides to charge him.
You're making my point.
No, I'm not.
The man was given immunity, and the white folks still went and had him arrested a year later. That's my point. So, again, how can you be for the Stand Your Ground law when you know that the application is totally going to be to the benefit of whites and to the detriment of black people? That's all I'm saying. It just kind of seems as if you believe that the law itself can be colorblind. There's no such thing as a colorblind law in this country. Every law is written for the benefit of white supremacy. Every law. That's what laws stand for. L-A-W-S, legal arm of white supremacy. You always get exceptions. There's always going to be an exception. And in terms of military science and in terms of controlling a group of people, you must have exceptions. There will always be an exception to every law. Why?
to legitimize it even further. So white people can say, this is not totally for us. Here's a case over here where the black man killed a white and he got immunity. Here's a case over here where a black woman killed a white woman and she got immunity. There must be exceptions because the exceptions legitimize the law. They can then point and say we have exceptions where black people were not mistreated, which then does what? Earn the faith and confidence of all other black people, and instead of fighting to get rid of the damn law, we allow it to stay just because white people could point to a few examples of where we benefited. The exception does not invalidate the rule, and we have to understand that. There will always be exceptions. They will fabricate them. The exception does not invalidate the rule. It is only just what it is, an exception. I've never been to prison. I have 6 college degrees. Okay? I am an exception, but I don't invalidate the rule. Most black men ain't got 6 degrees. Most of them have been to jail, or a significant number of them have. So I'm not going to allow anybody to use Umar Johnson, which is nothing but an exception, to try to invalidate the rule that there is a war against black men that is mass incarcerating us by the millions. Exceptions do not invalidate rules. There must always be exceptions in order to legitimize the system.
Well, Mr. Reed, hang on one second.
Yeah.
I wanted, because we do have some other people that called in. Hang on one second.
I'm sorry, Gus.
Nope, no apologies. Person that called in, Tasha T. I am reminded, though, Vernelia Randall, black female. She's the author of Dying While Black. She's been on the program repeatedly. Excellent material.
Okay. Wow. That was interesting. Here we go. One more time. If we look at the thinking of the people, and we have so many different angles that we are coming from, I always try to get people to understand that the first thing you have to do is get a foundation of knowledge in your brain, and the foundation that people of African descent should have in their brains is about their foundation, their ancient story. If you got that as a foundation, now you can begin to build a house. You cannot build a house without a foundation. Now, we listened to a brother. He's quite amazing. He's got a little bit of information on some politics, and he's going to try to debate this brother and talk about an exception. Like, that exception is supposed to invalidate the law that was designed to benefit the people. If you know anything about the global system of white supremacy, you'll understand that the school system, the public school system, was designed to benefit the people that created it and to further their interests. It wasn't designed for everybody to go in there and get a college education so they could take over the country. Now, you haven't held the country, so common sense would tell you that you've got to go back and look at what was it that you were being taught. Exactly what were you being taught? I told you what they did to us. You know, it was mandatory that we learn French, not our own ancient African language. The word Egypt was barely ever mentioned, and if it was mentioned, there was never any details. The word Pharaoh, I didn't even know what that was. And when I was growing up in school, and all of the teachers that taught us in the early schools that I was in were people who looked just like me. I had never been taught by a Caucasian teacher, but these people here had went to school, had went to college, and been indoctrinated in their brains to bring the same information back and under a banner where the Europeans say, this is what you got to teach. If you don't teach this here, you will lose your job. You see. So I went through first grade, second grade, third grade, for all the way up to seventh, eighth, ninth grade, in 10th grade, all the way up to the 10th grade, not knowing nothing about my ancient culture. Nothing. Oh, man, I could tell you all about Hitler. I could tell you about World War One. I could tell you about World War Two. I could tell you about France. I could tell you about George Washington. I'll dispute you down about Christopher Columbus, because Christopher Columbus is the one who discovered America. But fortunate enough for me, I was able to get rid of the foolishness and the stupidity and get it out of my brain and put something else different in there. Fortunate for me, I was able to do that. So, it behooves us to think about what I'm saying here.
John Martin situation. That's an excellent example of the failure of black leadership. I mean, they sent Al down there and Messy Jesse and the rest of them, and all they did was do what? Compromise with the power structure. Compromise with the power structure. You mean to tell me that this man shot a brother? He's not even a police officer. If he was, it still wouldn't have been justified, but he was a regular citizen. Town Watch pursued this brother. The Stand Your Ground law does not allow you to pursue the victim. The Stand Your Ground law protects you if you take somebody's life, if you felt that your life was being imminently threatened. But it does not protect you if you pursue. I just had this conversation with a black judge in New Jersey this past Sunday when I was speaking at one of the churches up there. Okay, and we had this conversation in depth. She said the Stand Your Ground law does not protect you if you pursue the victim. That man clearly pursued the victim. And black people stood around talking about why wasn't justice served? Because white supremacy is based on power, not laws. And this is why I differ with my brothers and sisters who are always talking about the damn law. The law is only going to work to a certain extent. This world is not run by law. It's run by power. The white man has been in control for damn near millennium, not because of laws, but because of power. When he went in and did what he did, when that white man went in and did what he did to Gaddafi and did what he did to Saddam Hussein and did what he did to us on the continent then and now, that ain't had nothing to do with no law. He broke every international law that's ever been written. He broke every one. Remember, the man with power has no need for the law because the law is written for the people who he oppresses. Study the use of law, and you'll find that law is used to control the behavior of the oppressed, not the oppressor. The oppressor don't follow no damn law. The cracker don't follow no law whatsoever. The Trayvon Martin case clearly showed you that. If he followed the law, that man would have been arrested on the spot because Stand Your Ground wasn't covered in his particular behavior. But because black power didn't force white power to do something that it didn't want to do, that man was allowed to stay out free. And even now, he's out on bail. He shouldn't have been given no damn bail. And if he was given bail, it should have been set higher than what it was. That was pocket change what they charged him on his bail. You only got to post 10 to 15% of it anyway. That was pocket change. But Zimmerman's father is a Jew, well-connected European. His mother connected. They part of white power. They are part of the power structure. So if we wanted that man to go to jail the night that he was arrested, we needed to do something different. Press conferences, rallies, marches, that shit is played out if it's going to be used by itself. It must be backed up with something stronger. What should have happened was black people should have descended on that town and shut it the hell down by disrupting traffic, disrupting the economic order, disrupting the natural order of life. We should have been on the damn highway, so anybody who thought they was flying out of Florida that day ain't going to be able to because we're blocking the road to the damn airport. We should have blocked the road to school so nobody would have been able to send their damn children to school. That's how you get their attention. You do not get the attention of the power structure by bringing in Al Sharpton because Al Sharpton represents the power structure.
one of the things about the Trayvon case that upset me, and I'm not negatively criticizing, I'm just constructively criticizing, because the Trayvon case wasn't about Trayvon. It was about every black man in this country. When his parents were interviewed on CNN about the case, in typical Christian fashion, and I respect them because I know that they're mourning, so I'm just analyzing this from a political standpoint, but in typical Christian fashion, which we tend to do all too much to our detriment, they spoke extensively about how they were not angry at Zimmerman and about how, as Christians, they had to forgive him. And they spoke at length, and I don't know if this was scripted by Sharpton or the NAACP or whatever other members of the black bourgeoisie who may have been influencing the family to begin with, because I really didn't see the need for them to be on CNN in the first place. But nonetheless, they made it crystal clear that they held no grudge. I thought that was bad. And I thought that was bad because this man committed a crime, took the life of your son, and you're hurting because of it. You could clearly see that they were hurting. But instead of letting the anger come out, letting the anger come out that y'all let this man free after he pursued and shot my son, and that there was at least one witness who saw that he had no need to kill him, and then after he shot him, stood over him and shot him again. Instead of the anger coming out and the pain coming out, the forgiveness and the compassion came out. See, that speaks to the political immaturity of black people. They were hurting, but they were supposed to unleash the anger. They were supposed to make it clear that if this man ain't arrested and convicted, we got a serious problem with that. We might can't reverse it, but we want America to know, like Emmett Till's mother did. Like Emmett Till's mother did. We want America to know that this was a damn hate crime. Zimmerman, this whole thing is a hate crime. Why is it not being cast as a hate crime? The reason it ain't being cast as a hate crime, and the reason why Sharpton and the rest of those fools ain't trying to position it like a hate crime, which is what it was, is because a hate crime is a federal offense. It is a felony. It is mandatory time that you must serve. That was a half white, half Hispanic, if he was Hispanic, whatever he was, killing a brother. That man identifies as white. He don't identify as a little man of color. His father's a Jew. He killed a black man. That was a damn hate crime, and he should have been charged with a hate crime. But the whole conversation over a hate crime never even surfaced. Never even surfaced, because even black people felt that it would have been going too far to accuse that man of a hate crime. And then to have his parents come on TV and talk about how compassionate they were, about how they don't hold a grudge and don't forgive him, that was not the time and place for that. That's something you say when you at church. That's something you say when you're amongst your family. But when you are on the European propaganda network, you make it clear to the world. Everybody watches CNN. Everybody knows about the Trayvon case. All six continents, all of them. Everybody was watching that interview. You were supposed to make it clear that this was trifling. This is what happens to black men on a regular basis. And an example needs to be made out of Zimmerman to all white men that you cannot take the lives of black men and walk. But instead of that, what did we get? We got a peaceful, I love everybody, I'm into the spirit of Christianity speech. And I think that their words opened the door. I can't say for sure, but as a political analyst, I think their words opened the door for a possible reduction in sentence, if not an outright acquittal of Zimmerman in carrying out that hate crime against our brother. I really think what they said out of their mouths made it easier for them to charge him with second degree instead of first, easier for them to give him a nickel and dime bail, and they make it easier for them to give him a life sentence if he gets a sentence at all. And the other thing I want to say, brothers, is this. Zimmerman getting arrested was not a victory. Zimmerman getting arrested was not a victory. Trayvon is still dead. Black people were celebrating. Zimmerman wasn't tried. He wasn't charged with anything, but at this point he has been, okay? But he hasn't been found guilty.
and he hasn't been given a sentence. So he was arrested and he was charged. But all he was charged. That has to be proven in court.
Right.
He has not been found guilty and has not been given a sentence. What the hell are we celebrating for? And if you look at the news media, they are shifting all of the compassion to Zimmerman instead of the family and to Trayvon. We have to stop celebrating. We celebrate too early, and we celebrate empty victories. The only reason why Zimmerman was arrested, listen to me clear, the only reason why Zimmerman was arrested is because this is an election year. President Obama and his Democratic think tank thought it was in the best interest of his party so he did not suffer from a black backlash at the polls to arrest Zimmerman to look like Obama is making sure justice is being carried out. He sent Al Sharpton down there. Al Sharpton is an Obama functionary. He sent Sharpton down there. That's why Sharpton was at the press conference with the family when they talked about Zimmerman finally being arrested. That was a campaign stunt. That's all it was. And don't be surprised that Zimmerman won't be found guilty, if at all, or sentenced until after Obama is reelected, because the arrest was nothing but a campaign stunt to make sure Obama got no backlash from the damn voters as a result of Zimmerman still being on the street. One of the things that we got to be crystal clear about, and of course I say this all the time and I said it on your show previously, and that is the essential necessity of changing the mindset of black people before you can change their condition. It is absolutely essential. Take the Trayvon case again as a case study. And unfortunately, brothers, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but there's going to be more Trayvons. There has to be more Trayvons. Because as my great ancestor Frederick Douglass said, the limits of tyrants. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by who? Themselves? No. He said, but by the people they oppress. Douglass taught us over 100 years ago that your enemy is going to go as far as you let him. He will not stop. He will not stop. So the fact that this regular citizen was able to shoot a child, point blank range, cold blood, and not go to jail for several weeks and then post a nickel and dime bail, do you know what that does to the everyday other white man and woman in America? That has already sown the seed in their head that I can do the same thing that Zimmerman did. Remember, in law, you have what's called case study. You have case law. Whenever a judge has to make a decision, if the case doesn't go to jury, or even if it does go to jury, the jury also has to consider what? Previous cases involving the same circumstances. So now, once Zimmerman gets his sentence, or even the fact that he was allowed not to be arrested for so long after shooting somebody in cold blood, a child, defenseless, guess what happens? Whatever Zimmerman's sentence is going to be, if he's found guilty, that automatically sets a precedent. So when the next white man or woman decides they want to kill another black man or woman, the judge automatically has to consider the what? The case law involving citizens who shoot black teens. And they'll be able to say, well, in Florida, we had the same circumstance, and he wasn't arrested for it because he was covered by the Stand Your Ground law, even though he pursued his victim. So since he was covered by the Stand Your Ground law, even though he pursued the victim, my client should also be covered by the Stand Your Ground law, even though they pursued the victim. So this ain't just about Zimmerman. This ain't just about Trayvon's family. This is about all of us, because Trayvon's case will become case law.
Okay, Morse. Now, does anybody have any questions about that?
Greetings. I'd like to invite you out to the Summit of the Moors, August 16th through the 18th, 2013, located in Jacksonville, Florida. 3 days of executing and planning of executive plans for 25-year agenda, operating as an economic unit. The presenters will be Shem L. of the Temerite 2 Project, Dr. Ali Muhammad and Minister Inky of the Black Genetic Tour. Sundiata Amael, Professor Isef Deanham L. Tahaka Amana L. Abundance Child, Fatima, the Alchemist Shabazz, Messiah L., and more. Topics will be the execution of urban geoponics, creating independent distribution systems, creating independent economic systems, genetics, private security force, the wholesale and manufacturing of natural products, Morristown, creating one in every state, Morris Eastside Farms, putting one in every state. You do not want to miss this summit. It is very enlightening, empowering, and most of all, it's applicable. Everything that we talk about, we do. Summit of the Moors, August 16th through the 18th. Log on to www.summitofthemoors.com. You can register for free. The summit is always free. You can also get your hotel room, which will be on the river at the Wyndham Hotel. That's www.summitofthemoors.com. The summits are always free. See you at the summit.
Going directly into the month of July, for those of you who have problems with your mortgage, you got student loan debt, you got that child support hanging on, and we're going to cancel those contracts. And for those of you who are trying to do that, before you do anything, call me at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Now, if you just want the most powerful archives in America, go right there to www.newfreehelpgroup.com. That's www.newfreehelpgroup.com. And give me a call to Hucker Amana L. Bay at 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'll get you some aid on that thing, okay? All right. Okay, Moors, y'all hold on for just a second because I got a very important question to ask.
I'm looking for our lives. I'm looking for our lives. I'm going to find. I've got some bags. I'm looking for our lives. I'm looking for our lives. Every day I'm looking for love. Here and there, and I'm searching everywhere, and I'm looking, I'm looking, I'm looking, 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 looking.
Moore's, we back. Now, here's my question. Now, based on what, and we're still talking about the thinking and the education of the people, because the brother said that people came out with this thing about forgiveness. And I've seen that kind of thing before. I've seen it with a lady where the Ku Klux Klan done killed her child, and she gets up there in the courtroom and say, "I've forgiven you. God has." All is in this, that, and the other. Now, to me, I don't understand that kind of thinking. And I guess that's based on how I was raised. I don't understand that. You can't kill my child and wait on me to come and tell you about no forgiveness by nothing. First place, ain't gonna be no talking. Ain't gonna be no arguing. It'd be totally quiet. Lord have mercy. Now, what I want to know from y'all is what do you think should have been done, or what should have happened? And this is a question that I'm putting to the listening audience. And I want you, don't everybody raise your hand at one time. We got 21 minutes for you to give me an answer. What do you think should have happened when Zimmerman shot Trayvon Martin? Okay. Area code 562. Tell me who you are, where you're calling from, what your question or comment. Let me have it.
This is Ashe Smiley Bay. I'm calling from California. Well, actually, what I think should have happened, I think he should have been arrested right away, first off, beforehand. Just based off my experience with dealing with the court system and the way they treat people, I had an incident, and, you know, my bail was set so high. Like, I think my bail was higher than his, and with my incident, it was no injured party or anything, and yet Zimmerman killed, you know, a person, a child at that, and he wasn't arrested for several weeks. It's just absurd to me. It just, you know, it's just stating right there that it was an issue. Yet it had been someone with our color, you know, they would have been arrested on the spot. And, you know, I think the family should have been in an outrage. I really, you know, excuse my graphic details, what I'm about to say. I really believe that Zimmerman's head should be ripped off his shoulders, and it should be put on stick, and the family should be allowed to walk in the street with his head hanging on that stick. And that's just how I feel, because I think they need to get what they deserve. I really do. So that's my opinion.
Okay, well, let me ask you something. Are you married?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, okay.
I have been married for over 11 years, and I have 6 children. So I am outraged with what happened to this child. And they're trying to paint a picture as if he was a man. And, I mean, a 17-year-old versus a 29-year-old just in strength-wise, is just, you know, he should have been be able to overpower that young man. And he also said himself that this kid, you know, he called him a kid. So, you know, he can't say that he didn't know, you know. It's just, I don't believe a word that comes out of his mouth. I just don't believe him. He's programmed, you know, he's trained. He's a habitual liar. You know, I think so, because, you know, his father is a, you know, retired magistrate. His mom was some sort of clerk. She worked within the courts, you know. So he's familiar. You know, he know they trained him. They told him to go speak with them without no lawyer present to make yourself look good. They told him everything, you know. So I don't buy his story. I really think he just killed that kid, you know, out of race issues, really.
Okay.
That's how I feel.
Well, all right. You take it easy now. Put his stick down for a minute. Don't put no hands on him. All right, sister, let me go on to the next call. Okay, Erico 850. Come on in here. Tell me who you are, where you calling from, which question to comment.
My name is Mafia Shakur, and I'm calling from Tallahassee, Florida.
Okay, brother, let me have it.
Oh, by me being in Florida and see how the rage is around here, really, I just think, like, justice just need to be done. And for me, seeing by the way he died, I think the same thing should happen to him. See, me by being from Florida, by Zimmerman following Trayvon, I think just Trayvon just whooped his ass, and then he just pulled a gun on him. But he caused that to happen, for that to happen. But to me, I just think he just need to die point blank, period. And when I look on Facebook and I see how black people just acting all of a sudden in Florida, like all of a sudden just everybody care and everything else, but really how it is in Florida, like everybody just wants something to talk about. I mean, we can kill our race every day, but soon as a white person kill a black person, all of a sudden somebody want to have something to talk about. Fuck having something to talk about. This man supposed to be dead. And if he beat that case, I still think he's supposed to be dead. He's still going to die, whether everybody know it or not. 25 to life, he get locked up, he going to be dead. Somebody going to kill him. Either way, he got a target on his head because somebody going to get him. Because how many some black people is ignorant about the situation, but then some black people really care. So what you going to do when you get the black people that care about the situation, all it going to take is one person to catch his ass, and he going to be dead. It might cause a motherfucking riot. Nigga, fuck it. Hell, we need a riot any day.
Wait.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I try to keep a minimum of cussing.
Oh, my fault.
Go ahead
on
the video. But don't you kill him right away. Just wait a little minute. Hold on.
All right.
Okay. All right, brother. I appreciate you calling in.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, do we have any more people who can answer this question about what you think should be done or what should have happened when Zimmerman shot Trayvon? What do you think should have happened? Go ahead and raise your hand. And I'm going to, we got 15 minutes here, and I'm going to deal with 9 in a minute, and that'll leave some more time for you, okay?
And by the way, the Stand Your Ground law was started where? In Florida. There were about, what, 3 states that pioneered in the Stand Your Ground law. Jeb Bush from Florida, I believe, signed the first Stand Your Ground law. This Stand Your Ground law thing is a new thing, brothers and sisters. This is new. This is a product of the 21st century. Do you know what this Stand Your Ground law is intended to do? It's intended to give white people the right to kill black people in cold blood. And look at the criteria, y'all. Look at the criteria. You do not have to prove. You do not have to prove that your life was in jeopardy or threatened when you shot the perpetrator. All you have to do is have belief. Listen to me, fellas. All you have to do is have a belief, a feeling, an intuition that this person is going to harm you. Now, let me ask you a question. Won't every white person in America have a belief that they're going to be harmed if they see a black man anywhere within their vicinity? Doesn't the Stand Your Ground law protect all white people in this country from all black men in this country? Doesn't the Stand Your Ground law give every white person the right to shoot and kill any black man? What white person can't argue that I was scared looking at the negative image that has been perpetrated about black men? What white person can't say that I felt threatened given the negative stereotype that surrounds black men. What white person can invoke the Stand Your Ground law to explain why they shot another black man dead? That Stand Your Ground law was the first states to martial law. Behind our backs, they have given white citizens the right to shoot to kill black people, and the only thing they need to be able to prove is that they felt they were in harm's way.
Incredible. And it derives from a more draconian law called the Castle Doctrine, which comes out of medieval Europe. You know, so as the brother Tasha Reek so eloquently puts it, you know, this is an extension of, you know, their crusades, the Inquisition, and the way that they use codes and ordinances, because it's not even a law.
The first law is the fact that white supremacy is the law. See, that's the one thing black people got to understand. The first code, the first law, for example, I do special education. Everybody knows that. Special education is federal law. My whole profession is regulated by federal law. But here's the thing. No matter how well I defend a child's right not to be miseducated, no matter how well I conduct a psychological evaluation proven with evidence from their tests, evidence from their assessments that this black child does not deserve special ed, does not deserve ADHD, does not deserve psychiatric med. In other words, I'm using the law to protect the child. At the end of the day, the first law is the law of white supremacy. The white man can still come in and say, despite all of that, as well put as you have laid it out, even though we have nothing to counteract it, because we are white, and black people don't get this, because we are white, and because white supremacy is the first law, we can still reject that shit because it didn't agree with what white people wanted. And we have to remember that. We have to remember that the code of white supremacy is higher and stronger than anything else that exists. White is right and white is might as far as they are concerned. We have to remember that. When white folks... When white folk came up with the AIDS virus, okay, when the Rockefellers put up the money for the United States Bioweapons Lab in Fort Detrick, Maryland, to manufacture those leaders of the AIDS virus, they had predicted, and all this was a part of Global 2000 and the whole eugenics movement in the post-civil rights era, they had predicted that by 2052, there wouldn't be a single African in Africa if their plan worked effectively. That was the plan. But as I rethink this, as I reanalyze the data and the timeline, I think a mistake may have been made. And what I mean by that, I think that their timeline of 2052, and I want your listening audience to hear me well, the timeline of the Rockefellers and the Trilateral Commission and the CFR in predicting that no black people would exist in Africa by 2052 if the rate of AIDS never slowed down, I don't think that that date was only for Africa. In fact, I'm pretty certain that they won't reach that goal by 2052 in the continent. As bad off as Africa is, I don't think they'll be able to wipe us all out on the continent by 2052. Now, we're still looking at nearly 50 years, so I don't want us to get comfortable. But what I am saying is this. I think that 2052 date was not only for Africa extension, but it was for the black man and woman's extension in America. I believe that the eugenics movement has set a date of 2052 to ensure that there are no black people in America except those who are absolutely necessary for the maintenance and perpetuation and survival of white supremacy. They won't get rid of all of us. They will keep some for research, for study, for cloning, to be used as functionaries of state like Al Sharpton and Barack Obama on the international level. But I do believe that 2052 is the projected date upon which time no black man or woman or child is to exist in this country. Everything that I've studied, everything that I have researched have brought me to the conclusion that if it's up to the white man, if it's up to him, we have about 38 more years to go unless we do what? Organize. We need organization. Information is good. The information is good because if people don't know why they should organize, they won't. So I'm never going to outlaw the importance of information. But information without organization is ultimately useless. And unfortunately, in the conscious community, and in the not-so-conscious community, and in the regular black population, everybody's pursuing more information. But I want to be really clear about something. That information don't mean shit if it is not leading us to organize ourselves en masse. En masse, not 10 and 20. I'm talking 100 and 200. En masse. We have to be organized en masse. What does Stokely call Michael Kwame Ture say? If you organize a little bit, you get a lot done. If you organize a little bit, you get a little done. If you organize a lot, you get a lot done. And if you organize on a grand scale, you're going to be able to achieve grand accomplishments. Black people aren't organized at all. We're sitting home. We're in our apartments, our efficiencies, our homes. We're in the projects, and we got a whole bunch of DVDs and books and CDs and tapes, but there's no damn information can't save you. In a physical war, you got to get out there and fight. The fact that you know about your enemy means nothing. What are you going to do to resist him? So I'm saying that the conscious community, exactly, the conscious community has to evolve into an action community. The conscious community has to evolve into an action community. Conscious means you're aware. Conscious means you know. Conscious means you got the information. But what good is it if the information isn't leading to mobilization? If the information isn't leading to mobilization, do you know what we just did? Not only did we make the information an enemy to the people, we just made consciousness a new fucking religion.
Okay, we back, and I think I've opened up line 562. Let me check. 562.
Yes.
I've already talked to you, Linda.
Yes.
Okay, all right. I just want to make sure, because I went off the page and had to come back on. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we only have 5 minutes and 30 seconds left, and I just want to say that this is all a part of the educational process. I want to put that information in there to show the thinking of our people in times of crisis when something like this happens. We have these kind of things going on all over the United States, and I remember reading the story of Sitting Bull in Custer, and I think I've told this story before, where General Custer, he's coming in, and they're going to slaughter the Indians. But Sitting Bull, he had friendly tribes, and he had enemy tribes, and he sent his people out to say, go tell the friendly tribes that we have a common enemy. They're coming in here and try to destroy us. And go to the enemy tribe and let them know that they have the same problem, too. So when Custer came down in the valley for the walk, he ran into Sitting Bull and the tribes, but then after things started heating up down there, he noticed that the entire nation was coming. Area code 813.
Yes, sir. The brother that just spoke about the organization without any action, I just wanted to say I totally agree with him. And we've been trying to do a whole bunch of things, but nothing's going to get done. We can do all this talking, do all the learning that we want to, but if nobody takes any action, nothing's going to get done. I just want to commend that brother for speaking out the way that he did.
Okay, so that brother, Dr. Umar Johnson, laying it out for us, and I appreciate you, sister, telling us what you think about this thing. Now, we only have 3 minutes left, and I just want to say that not only was Sitting Bull situation, the same thing occurred with the Zulu Nation. When the British came up and down there, they seen a few thousand Africans, but after a while they turned around, here come the entire nation. And see, this is what needs to happen any time a brother or sister's gunned down in the streets on one of these kind of crimes. The entire nation need to come. And they need to be blockades, the highways, airports, the whole, shut it down. Get up in there, and you shouldn't have but one question. That's who did it and where he at. You know, all this about we're going to do an investigation might be fine, but you ain't going to have time. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and until next time, ladies and gentlemen, you all take it easy, okay? All right.
More tears to shake. I can see.